This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Is this better? Okay, great. I'm going to be addressing the question of how would you evaluate the claims that Arakawa and Ginz are making. I mean, we read in the paper, we hear them say that if you move into one of their architectural establishments, or if we were to design a home for older people to live, that people aren't going to die, that we're going to reverse destiny. What does this mean? If we were going to talk to a funder and say we need X numbers of millions of dollars because we want to do this project, and at the end people aren't going to die, how would we know if we've been successful? Is dying just a matter of stopping to breathe? I mean, is that our definition of death? Because I think if we were to put all of our eggs in that basket, it's a very hard one to establish the veracity of. I mean, how do we know how long those people would have lived had they not come into that facility? Would they have lived the same amount of time, or would they have lived a different amount of time? So putting all of our eggs into the stopping breathing aspect of dying, I think, would be the wrong approach. So what I've tried to do, and this is in conversation with them, we had lunch together before the Paris conference, and what you have in front of you is actually draft two. I presented something just like this in Paris, only this has been added to by many of your comments, and I'm hoping that as a result of today, we can work this out a little bit further. So, let's see if I can get this PowerPoint going. So, we have an architectural intervention, and it's going to create imbalances that, such as we've heard about in movement patterns. It's going to totally disturb daily routines because of the way if we took a look at the Biosleeve house, it's a very different way of living, and it's going to create the tentativeness that we've heard about. So, how do we go about evaluating this? Well, I'm going to suggest that we look at three categories of mediators. Now, what's a mediator? A mediator is the process by which you get from the intervention to the outcome. Before we talk about the mediators, let's look for a moment at the bottom of the page that you have, which says that at the end of all of this, people are going to have a more positive attitude toward life, they're going to have greater feelings of optimism, and they're going to have more positive feelings about themselves. They're going to have more self-confidence, a better self-image, and a better body image. I was very struck when I read the New York Times article by something that the builder said. He said, I don't know if they're going to be right about this reversible destiny stuff, but I know that people come in there and they have fun. They enjoy it. So maybe if I were redoing this tomorrow, I would add at the bottom that one of the outcomes of living in a facility like this would be having fun. So how do we get from the intervention to the bottom of the page? And I'm going to argue that perhaps it would be helpful to think about three categories of what are called mediators. That's how you get from point A to point C. Now, on the left column, what's different from what the Paris version of this and today's version is that before I gave primacy to the cognitive engagement, and I've switched that, and I think we really need to come in at the sensory level. So I'm saying that there's sensory re-education, there's cognitive engagement, and then there's all this stuff about anxiety and stress arousal that we've heard about. And under the stress arousal, I think there is two kinds of categories of stress. One is the social aspect and one is the biological, the neurobiological aspect. Now, one of the things that we need to think about is the impact of time on this whole process. And this is a moderator. You'll see on the page, I put Ruben's name on here too, because so much of my thinking has been influenced by Ruben. He wrote a paper in 1986 called Mediators and Moderators, where he distinguished between the two, and it's a very useful distinction. A moderator is that which either increases or attenuates the effect of something. So I'm going to argue that over time, things change, that if we were to evaluate the impact of their building on the first week, it's going to be very different from at the end of the first month or at the end of the first year. So I've tried to think about what is the initial impact on people if we were to just come in and sort of look at them after a couple of hours or a day, after a couple of weeks, and then maybe after the first month. Now, this is totally changeable. I mean, you know, if you think this is off the wall, we could make this the first day or the first month. I mean, it doesn't really matter, but it's time one, time two, time three. And I loved your comments. So I've already talked about this is the stuff at the bottom of the page. Now, I'm just basically going to go through these really quickly in the interest of time. And you can see you have this all in front of you where you can look up top. But if you look at the sensory reeducation column, time one, we all know that there's going to be this disorientation of movement and what we call unfreezing of habitual actions. People are disoriented, they're confused, and you know it's not a pleasant moment. After some time, there's going to be creation of new multimodal sensory motor skills. People are going to be adjusting to this. They're going to have greater kinesthetic and tactile awareness. Now, these are all hypotheses. I'm saying they will. We hope they will, and we would measure whether they do. But what I'm interested in is your reaction as to whether this is off the wall. Can we expect this to happen, or am I wrong that this wouldn't even be something we ought to look at? And this is where I'm asking for your feedback. And then somewhere after the first couple of weeks, we would see this development of new perceptual landing sites. And then as time moves on, some of these would be stabilized, there would be a flexibility, there would be greater sensation seeking, and greater spatial intelligence. So that over time, we see a progression from this total confusion to this tentative, very tentative state to something much more positive on the sensory level. Looking now at the cognitive engagement, you see a very similar pattern. We would start out with cognitive confusion. There would be an unfreezing of the habitual schemata or mindsets that we typically expect in a rectilinear room that with a flat floor. Then there would be a total disruption of automaticity. If you interviewed people at this time, they'd probably want to go home, I would think, because it's very confusing and very disorienting. However, if they stick it out for a while, there would be much more of an awareness. They would get tuned in. They would get engaged. They would get cognitively tuned in. They would be more conscious of their actions, and there would be a greater capacity to image and dimensionalize new landing sites. So this is kind of after a week or two or three or four. And over time, I would argue that we could expect to see greater cognitive flexibility, and we might think about less stereotyping, more open-mindedness, greater tolerance of ambiguity. They might have greater novelty seeking, greater creativity, greater risk-taking, greater intellectual skills, and greater feelings of cognitive control. But this would take some time. Moving over to the third column and the anxiety, stress, social aspects. You know, if you go into, this is, you know, I'm talking about old age. Any of us who's ever visited a parent or a friend in an old age home has the experience of walking in and seeing a room full of people not talking to each other and staring into space. I mean, it's totally depressing because people aren't engaging with each other. And we've seen this, Ruben and I, in visiting parents and so forth. It's very, very depressing. So one of the big differences, I think, about it, if we think of this as if we think of building a social environment, it will create the need for greater social comparison, greater networking with the next person. That would be right even at the beginning. And so there would be greater seeking of relationships with others, and as a result, better social coordination, and this whole aspect of cleaving that we've heard about, the need to cleave, the need to belong. A little bit later in time, you might see a greater need to be distinctive. So that would be the separateness aspect of cleaving. So the cleaving has the two parts, the need to be together as a group and the need to separate yourself out. I would argue that if you looked at these people over time, because of their need to be more social than they might have been otherwise, there would be improved social skills and functioning in groups, more satisfying relationships with others, better conversational skills, better social coordination, and reading of nonverbal cues. It's interesting. I think a lot of this is what Dr. Farber was talking about with trying to build a facility for autistic kids. He's really banking on a lot of these same things to occur by doing this in a social environment with the autistic kids in his project. And then maybe we would even have more appropriate emotional responses. Moving over to the final category, under the psychobiological aspects, I think at the very beginning, along with all of this uncertainty at the sensory and the cognitive level, and this nervousness, there would probably be elevated anxiety signals. There would be greater, higher blood pressure, higher heart rate, and GSR is galvanic skin response, which is the measure of sweating. So people might really be a lot more, very anxious. So you wouldn't want to, you know, say that you'd have to give them some time in the environment. I think in the second phase, maybe a week or two into it, the blood pressure would go down, and so would the other indices of stress. And here's where I think we might begin to see a suppressed, the suppressed immune system. I wasn't sure where to put it, time one, time two. I mean, I don't expect your immune system to be affected in the first week. It might take some time, so I kind of threw it into the second category. But I'm arguing that the stress could actually be harmful to one's immune system right at the beginning. It might take a little bit of time, maybe a month, before we would see the other kinds of things occurring, the improvement to the immune system, greater physical strength, greater endurance, and over time would be the longer lifespan measured by exactly what one typically thinks of as living longer. So, and this is just a repeat at the bottom. So what I'd love to get your comments now, I don't have time, but I would urge you to, if you have anything pressing and you think any of this stuff is crazy, or exit out, and if there's some things we totally forgot to think about, please include them, because over time, we hope that we will have an old age facility and we will have to evaluate it. So thank you very much.